Welcome, everybody. Good morning. I hope you're all awake and alive. And apparently there's a room switch, just in case you're confused. This is Bare Naked App, the Figures Behind Web App. So if you're not here for this, then might as well leave now. is everybody doing well? Awake? Okay, good. I'm really excited about this panel. It's something that we've really wanted to help people who are building web apps by sharing some of these figures, and I think today is really going to do that. So let me get started. The background of why we're doing this is a site that we did called barenakedapp.com, and it was a site where my wife and I, Jill, we talked about the entire process of building one of our web apps, which was called Amigo, and we shared, you know, the figures behind it and what went wrong and what didn't and what went right and what worked and what didn't, and it was a lot of fun. So we thought in sort of the vein of that, we would try to do this panel. So my name is Ryan Carson, and I'm the director of Carson Systems, and we've built two web apps. One's called DropSend and one's called Amigo. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about DropSend today. And DropSend is a program for sending large files that you can't email. To my left is Anne, and she's from Maya's Mom. And Maya's Mom is essentially a social network for moms that allows them to share their frustrations and their photos and journals, and it's very popular. It's a wonderful site. And to her left is Mark Hedlund, and he is one of the founders of Wasabi, which is a site that helps people share their finances and what they spend money on, and it also allows people to share his sort of spending tips and things like that. And he used to be at O'Reilly, so. And to his left is Mike McDermott from FreshBooks, and FreshBooks is a brilliant tool for sending invoices online, and it's proving to be very popular. And to his left is Beatrice Tarka, and she founded Mobissimo. And probably most of you have used it. It's a site for searching for flights and travel, and it searches how many sort of 50 different services, something like that. It's amazing. So if you need to get a cheap flight, it's a place to go. So we invited all these folks as we thought that they were a great example of web apps that were very well executed, and they were kind enough to share some of their figures. So we're just going to go over quickly the format. We're going to go over the numbers really quick, and then we're going to try to get to questions as soon as possible, because I think most of the interesting things in this panel are going to happen from you guys asking questions. So they will, yeah. I'll put those up, and I'll try to put up a URL real quick at the end, so you guys don't have to manically write these down. So you can if you want, but... So DropSend costs around $48,000 to build. I'll go into that more in the future. FreshBooks cost $20,000 to build. Maya's Mom costs around $70,000. Mobissimo was $60,000. And Wasabi was $200,000. And I just want to explain sort of what it means, what this figure is the price it costs to actually get it live. And then after that, there's the cost of running it, which don't include this. So this is just, let's get it live and open it up to the world. So I'm going to turn it over. Let me just go through DropSend real quick, and then I'll turn it over to these guys. So that figure, this figure, 48,000, is broken down as... we spent about $9,500 on design. That was one designer, and he stayed at my house for a whole month and did everything, the branding and the site and the web app. And that proved to be, actually, I'm really glad we did it that way. Development was around $25,000, and that included one developer that built the web app. And we also have a desktop app that was built, and that also included front-end development and various different things. I actually had to give a little bit of equity away to the developer to do it cheap. He did it for $11,000, and I kind of said, "Well, general's agreement. If we ever sell, I'll give you 2%." And thankfully, he was okay with that. So that's the way I kept that cheap, because it would have been a lot more expensive. Hardware and hosting, just kind of initially, was around $7,200. That was just the cost of the servers. during, it was a setup cost and then a couple months of running it. And then lawyers and accountants, things like getting trademarks and making sure that, you know, we weren't breaking any laws and, you know, figuring out, there's this confusing thing in England, because we're based in England, called VAT, which is like sales tax, and we had to figure that out. So that was about $6,000. So that's Drop's End. And again, you know, write down your questions if you have any questions, and we'll be taking questions at the end. So, oops, oh. So switching over to Mike. Okay. Over to you.
Yeah, so I'm Mike from FreshBooks, and as you can see, we didn't really spend a penny on design or development to get the thing built. And the way that worked was, I was running a design and development shop at the time, and I did the design, and my co-founder, this guy Joe, is finishing up some postdoc work in computer science at U of T, developed the thing. So we just did it in our spare time from January to, it's sort of about 14 months on our own time before going live. Hardware and hosting, there are some, had sort of four categories to choose from here. We had a bunch of expenses in there.
Why don't you break it down a little bit?
Well,
if you can.
It's so long ago, to be honest. I don't really remember. I did send some information along that was not on this slide, which I think is sort of more interesting, and which is what it took us to reach break even. And we spent about $430,000 to reach break even, with a low point in our bank account at one point at about $320,000. So that is about half of that money, about $140,000 went to marketing. So I think those numbers are probably a little more interesting than those ones.
Okay. All right, let's go to the next one. Over to you, Anne.
So the first thing I would advise anyone who's thinking about creating an app is to build it, obviously, as cheaply as you can and to get it out so you can figure things out as soon as possible. So for me, my background, I come from Yahoo. I ran a business development for a search and marketplace group there. I'm not a technical person, so I wrote the product spec and then hired people to build it. We made the choice not to develop overseas. I wanted to hire an engineer and a relatively senior one to build, who still heads our engineering team. So our development costs were basically paying him for about half a year to get it out. Our design costs, same thing. We did contractor with design. I felt like that wasn't as critical a position for us to have someone full-time on the team, so that's all contractor. The hardware and hosting, servers to get it launched. But I definitely overall would say keep your costs as low as you can and get something out, because you learn a ton once you have something out, so long as you have the analytics in place to track.
So you have zero for lawyers, accountants, and I mean, there's probably some of that in there, but did you have to do a lot of, people share sort of their stories on Maya's Mom? Did you have to make sure that, what if people libel each other or anything like that? Or?
Sure. So we spent nothing on that. That is actually a real figure. My background, originally I was a corporate securities attorney, so I don't do any legal work at all anymore. That would be a very bad idea. But the law firm that I used to work for does a lot of transaction work in Silicon Valley, and they are happy to defer billing until your first, in our case, our second venture round. So that's been great. As far as liability goes, I may kick myself later for saying this, but I think the most important thing to get something launched is to get something out there, and I wouldn't worry so much. I guess YouTube is actually a great example here. I wouldn't worry too much about legal risks before you get something out there. Said as a former lawyer.
Don't really listen to that.
And that's not legal advice. No one come back and sue me.
Disclaimer.
So before we move on, I just quickly, so the audience knows, which one of you guys are primarily venture-backed and which ones of you are essentially sort of bootstrapped? So just raise your hand if you're venture-backed. Cool. And bootstrapped.
Yes.
All right. Okay, cool. So let's move on. Let's move over to Mobismo.
Hi. What should I tell you? We did design our site actually externally, so I'm French, and if you don't understand my accent, just raise your hand and we'll go slow. I used Polish and Italian graphic designers and developers to do the front end because we were not good at front end. We developed ourselves with my co-founder, the query engine. So we basically had a very split architecture of the site, front end separated from the query engine and so on. The development cost was about $47,000. That included the tech development, one license for airport database that at the end we had to rewrite ourselves. It wasn't serving any specific purpose that we had in mind. Hardware and hosting, well, that was very interesting. We have launched 3 years ago, and we launched Mobissima on $39 co-hosted solution, a hostway in Chicago, and it worked until the first Time magazine article, and that we went into a different stage.
I think that's a good example of saving money, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Keeping it cheap until you have to.
And it worked beautifully, actually. I recommend the company. The other cost included our two laptops, and development server that was in our bedrooms, basically. And that's it. The rest of it was lawyers and accountants, and that's the cost to actually just establish the company in the U.S. to incorporate it in Delaware. So that's basically the cost.
Cool. And Beatrice and I were sort of chatting, and the interesting thing for their story is that it was quite cheap, really, to build Mobissimo, but they got covered in Time, and all of a sudden they got hit really hard, and they realized, well, if we're going to grow, we actually have to spend a lot of money now. And I think that's one thing we were sort of chatting about in the back. And the truth is it's very easy to build and very cheap to build an app, but it gets quite expensive afterwards if you want to actually grow it and maintain it. And that's a whole different story. So that's one thing I hope that we sort of communicate today. So we'll go ahead and move on. All right, over to you, Mark.
So with Wasabi, nearly all of the costs of development of getting to launch were in development. These costs were from about February of 2006 through to November of 2006 when we launched. We actually made a decision early on to build our own infrastructure for something called DataSync. So we import your financial information from your bank or credit card website, so that you don't have to deal with your crappy whatever Wells Fargo website. You can just come to our site and see your data in one view. And there are companies that will do this for you, and you know, for a fairly small amount of money, they were willing to get us going, the kind of first taste is free model of you know, getting us hooked on their service for getting that data sync. But we felt that if we kept that up, that they would have full price control over us, because getting data out of the banks is so essential to our service. So we decided to rebuild that infrastructure from scratch, and that was an expensive decision, you know, relative to the other companies on the panel. We had 5 developers instead of 1 working up until launch, and so that explains why the cost is so high. But on the other hand, now we own the infrastructure, and we own the tool that's essential to building our business. So nearly everything we spent until November was on that. We did, like Ann did, we did deferred compensation with a law firm, which I don't think, in our case anyways, was such a great choice. Maybe I should have worked for the law firm first. We did an equity arrangement with our designer. But nearly everything was just writing the code.
So real quick, just go into that. Why wouldn't you do a compensation deal with lawyers again?
Well, I don't think that it never works. I just think that, you know, especially right now, there are a lot of startups that have been funded, a lot of startups going to lawyers and saying, you know, we want your attention. And if you go to them and say, we'd like you to not get paid until we have a funding event, then you're going to fall below, the funded companies in their priority list. And the result is going to be that your calls will come back a little bit more slowly. You know, the advice you get will probably be the same, but it will just take a lot more effort to get it. And we felt like we were sort of, you know, far down the list of people who would get a call back. If you're trying to get through a funding event, that's very difficult. If you're trying to make it so that you can get the money in order to be able to pay them and they're not calling you back, that's not in your benefit and arguably not in theirs either, but it just is a lot harder to get and keep their attention that way.
Okay, thanks. All right, moving on. So so we want to talk a little bit more. So after you build the thing, how much does it actually cost to grow it and maintain it? And it's a slippery slope, and we tried to compare apples to apples here. But what we're trying to convey, I think, and in general as the panel, is that you guys really need to prepare for the fact that it will cost money once you launch. And it's, I think a lot of focus is put on the fact that you can build cheaply, but, you know, building doesn't really matter. Growing is what matters. So let's just get right into the figures. So we spend a piddly $3,600 a month. And I've been blogging about the fact that we're trying to sell DropSend and that we don't do any marketing whatsoever for it. And this is why it's so cheap, because we literally do nothing. I wouldn't advise that, actually. So, so you know. Next up is FreshBooks, around $46,000 a month. And this is monthly, just to clarify. Maya's Mom, about $30,000. And Movissimo is $150,000. And Wasabi is $3,000 plus. And I'll let Mark go into that. And let's hand it right over. I'll do drops in real quick. So design, we don't do any new design for the site. Thankfully, Ryan, the guy that did it, did a great job, and it's lasted us for over a year now. So we don't have any designers on board. Development, we pay a very small retainer fee to the developer. I would not recommend that. What's happening now is we're being limited by the fact that we can't grow the application as much as we want. And that's because we don't have a full-time developer on board. And I blogged a little bit about that, saying, you know, fire your freelance developer as soon as possible, because we're being very limited by the fact that the freelancer who built it just doesn't care about it because we paid him. And it causes a real problem when you want to grow the app and when you have bugs to fix. So I would recommend, if possible, to get somebody full-time on board. Hardware and hosting, it's fairly inexpensive, about $2,900 a month. And lawyers and accountants, there is some accountancy fees in that, but Carson Systems mainly bears that. So it's pretty cheap, but the app isn't growing very super quickly. So I think there's a direct payoff there. So FreshBooks, hand over to you, Mike.
Thanks. So there are the numbers. Basically goes like one person, three person, three person for the first three lines there. Hardware and hosting, pretty self-explanatory. Lawyers, all those numbers are going up basically every month. Things that aren't in there because the buckets we are given are things like rent and what have you. Sales and marketing's not in there. So they're fairly self-explanatory.
Fair enough.
I think there's one thing that you said though, which was kind of interesting, to just touch on before moving on with that, regards to building that original team and outsourcing that development piece and then winding up with somebody who just doesn't care anymore. I think if you are thinking of building an app, there's lots of good blog posts and what have you out there about this kind of thing, but it's really important to get a good mix. And people often say it's like a team of three, right? And you have your, and if you guys, there's a really good book, The E-Myth or whatever, that just kind of talks about that dynamic. And you need these sort of three personality types where you have an entrepreneur, a manager, and a technician. And ideally, you have them all three involved. And they've got skin in the game. Like, they're sort of heart and soul involved. I don't think you can, if you're trying to bootstrap, certainly, you need more than, their heart's got to be in it. So you got to arrange things to ensure that that's there.
Definitely. I agree. So we'll move on. All right, over to you, Ann.
So these are maintenance costs. These do not include investment to scale the business. But if we just wanted to stay maintained, this is what it would cost us. I think for any app, you have to decide. Your first decision is, are you doing this for fun? Are you doing this because you want to make money from it? And I think if it's the latter, you definitely need to think about how the business scales, and that definitely, in most cases, costs money. So I think it is very important to think before you launch something what you're in it for. Is it something that's fun, or is it something that's business? If it's something that's business, you're going to have to put money behind it. So it's not just maintenance, it's also growing. And that's, again, why I would put something out as quickly as you possibly can to see what sort of natural user adoption you get, so you know how much money you'll have to put behind to market it.
Definitely. Quick thought on that. We had a chat with a guy yesterday, and there's three things that can happen to your app when you launch it. It can fail, it can do okay, or it can succeed. And you actually have to think about all three cases, because failure is easy. You just cut your losses and have a beer and wish you didn't do it. But marginally succeeding is a totally different game. It's like, well, we're bringing in money, but there isn't really enough money to invest more money, so it's just sitting there. And I think I would encourage everybody to think about that, because if you're in that place, which I think probably, I would say a large percentage of new web apps are going to be in that place. They're okay, they work, but they're not YouTube, you know, and they're maybe not even very profitable. So if that happens to you, what are you going to do? You know, are you gonna fire a developer? Are you gonna bring on a cheap developer? Or are you gonna sell it? You know, just think about that. And then success is easy. You know, make millions, great. So if that happens to you, sweet. Over to you, Beatrice.
So I understand that you can either build a company for having fun or for business. At Mobisimo, we built something that we want other users to use. And that's, I think, the key to success. If you get your users to use your product frequently on basis, you're going to make money, you're going to bootstrap your company, you're going to get financing or whatever else is needed. So whatever you have to think about is how much money is going to be needed. The picture that you have right now here, it's Mobisimo 3 years later. Those numbers are going to change because we are growing. Right now, most of our expenses are going towards team. So basically, just to operate the site, we have 4 sites, one in the U.S., in France, UK, and India, which is a total different ballgame to operate now 4 different sites with different languages, slight changes in the interface. Hardware and hosting went up. Obviously, as we have now over 2 million users coming to a website, you have to have more servers, you have to have load balancers, you have to have data center. Those equipments are going to get old, so you have to replace them. And you have a bandwidth cost. It is not expensive, but it adds up. Lawyers and accountants. Well, today we are around $2,000 a month. And I have to say that there was a period of time that was more expensive. When you were going to go through the financing or your first major contract, unless you have a friend who is a lawyer, it may actually cost you for financing up to $40,000, $50,000 if you are dealing with the top VC firm. With some others, you're probably going to end up spending $20,000 for contracts with your suppliers, for example, to get the first marketing contracts for ads and so on, so that you have sort of a template form. It may cost you anything from $4,000 to $10,000. But once you're going to kind of pass through this stage, afterwards you have pretty much stable expenses from time to time just to consult on something, and you can keep it pretty much in control. And the rest of the money, it's really marketing. Now it's how you go and actually spread the news about your company and get the customers to come back to the site and use it.
So Beatrice, the $60K for marketing, is that just for ads, or is that for an ad sales team, or is that people? What is that really?
Marketing, it's basically everything that is needed for you to bring the customer to your website. So it is a PR cost, and again, it counts for countries. We have PR teams in 4 countries. We don't operate one single PR agency, but 4 of them. A little bit of Google AdWords. And we have just this year started to think about SEM. Believe it or not, we have not built the site for the search engine optimization. So we were not, our thought was not, oh, let's just cheat everybody. Let's put as many hidden words and just try to play the traffic rules. We really wanted to get the customers who are going to come to our website because they really want to look for travel and buy travel, because those are the most valuable customers. Those are the ones that will remember your site. It keep coming back every month.
I want to ask you, raise your hand if you've spent a lot of time and possibly money on search engine optimization for your product.
Time, not money.
Okay, cool. It's interesting because we haven't either. It's one of those afterthoughts where we thought, oh my gosh, I haven't thought about it. And it'd be interesting to...
We've kind of done both, so maybe it's worth pointing out. We've been around for like almost 3 years now, and we just renamed our company from Second Sight to FreshBooks probably 7 months ago. And the first go-around, my background in design and development, we were an internet marketing consultancy, and we did a lot of search. So that first site we built was really built for search. And when we rebranded, we decided to just build for brand. And I don't know, it's now we're in a place where we actually have two sites, one that does one thing really well, and the other one does the other thing really well, and it's you have to make some trade-offs. There's a lot of constraints with building for search. You lose some of the brand stuff.
And so. I would just say that, you know, if your bank data were search engine optimized, you wouldn't be very happy about that, so we haven't done that.
Yeah, you don't
know. I think building for search engine optimization is a very important thing to do. I think if you have the opportunity to take the time to understand what search engines like, you'll get a lot of bonus traffic. Definitely don't sacrifice the user experience for search engines, but there's a very long tail of terms, and Google is obviously a widely used product, so I would highly recommend at least thinking about the way to be attractive to them when you build.
Cool. I think there's also a real consideration there in terms of the kind of startup you're running. Like, you have a lot of content on Maya's Mom, right? So if you're a lot of content, a lot of pages, it's hugely advantageous to think about search. We basically wound up going from like a 30-page website, which still is not a lot of pages, to like a 4-pager. And so it's not as relevant. But if you have thousands and thousands of pages, definitely think about search.
All right, so let's move on. Oh, sorry. I'm backwards there.
I
already talked about that, didn't we? Let's talk about Maintenance Wasabi.
Sure. So I should say that we just announced a funding round about a week ago, so the salaries and development are all up. Well, yeah. The salaries and development are all in shift. We are paying below market because all of our developers have significant equity stakes in the company. I agree with what Ryan was saying earlier that if you have developers who you're not paying at all or have no particular interest in the company's success, then that's going to be very, very difficult down the road. We did actually start out with a developer that we were not paying cash, and very quickly it became clear that, you know, he was not going to be able to give us full attention, as I was saying, with lawyers. And with lawyers, we decided to live with it. With developers, I think you can't make that decision. You have to have people. I mean, if what you're doing is at all sensitive to the engineering of it, then you have to have people who are deeply invested in it being a great product and really, really want to make it work. And we're lucky we have five guys who are fantastic for that. And, you know, I'm really happy with that group. But those are significant expenses when you're early on. For hosting, we do everything through Rackspace. You know, there are a bunch of different companies you can go to. Server Beach is one that people like a lot. You know, I think a lot of those companies will charge you very small amounts of money. And if you're buying server hardware, at this point, one of our investors, Mark Fletcher, the guy who started Bloglines, said that he went through and bought a bunch of hardware for Bloglines and later was like, why did I do that? You know, why did I spend that money? I just don't think there's any point for a startup to buy server hardware at this point.
Totally agree. All right, let's keep moving. So yearly revenue, many of these are top secret. So
it's not a secret that we have none.
Yeah, except for Wasabi, which is zero, which is awesome. So DropSend, this is growing, which is kind of cool, but it's about $150,000 a year. It grows by about, it's bizarre, like $986 a month. And that's not that great because we're not doing any marketing, so we're going to change that. FreshBooks, not willing to share. Maya's Mom, nope. Vismo, And Wasabi, like you said, zero. Now, what matters, though, is profit, right? Revenue is no good unless you're making profit. So we actually, percentage-wise, we're quite profitable, make about $106,000, but that's because we spend no money. So it's kind of a bizarre experience. Maya's Mom, you guys are venture-backed and you're moving towards profitability, but you're not there yet. So Abismo is pretty freaking impressive, $450,000 before taxes. And I think that Beatrice is a great example of a web app that's an impressive example of how you can be profitable in this field. And Wasabi, because it's brand new, is zero. So this is the overview in case you want to write stuff down, but I think most of the interesting stuff is going to happen in the questions. So we'd like you guys to sort of line up and ask questions if you have any. If you don't, I've got plenty, so feel free to start lining up for questions. I'll start off, though. Can you guys just go down the line and tell us how many full-time people you have each?
Sure. We have 5 full-time with 5 more contractors.
Okay, cool.
I believe we have 8 full-time with 6 of those paid.
Cool.
And by the way, we're hiring.
Cool.
Yeah, we're 7, I guess technically 8, because we've just hired somebody who's starting in April, and we're trying to fill 2 positions right now,
okay.
So it'll be 10.
Mobissimo is a 15-people team. We are 8 in the U.S., and in the other countries we have 2 to 3 people.
Okay, great. I've got some questions. Go ahead.
Aaron Dragishin, Wondermill. I'm just wondering if you've ever hired a PR team. I know you have at Mobissimo, but how's that worked out in terms of doing that in-house versus bringing somebody in or versus contracting it out? And have you gotten enough press that you thought it was worthwhile?
Right. We'll just go down the line real quick. Okay. So I'll start. No, we don't have a PR agency for DropSend. I try to do most of the marketing just by mainly word of mouth and networking. So
We don't have a PR firm. We did experiment with a PR consultant. And I think, depending on what your market is, I think it's a good idea to at least think about PR, whether you have a consultant or not. PR is the cheapest way to get the word out about your company and your product. But I think that at the stage that we are at, having launched the end of October, I think the most important person to do PR is the founder, and whether you get someone to help you with that or not, I think the founder is definitely, particularly when I am Maya's mom, I think that really matters.
Cool. I am very, very lucky. I've worked twice with a woman named Debbie Pfeiffer, who at a company I founded in 2000 called Popular Power, she was our PR person, and she is amazing, just much, much better than any PR firm I've ever worked with. You know, we'll call people up and say, hey, you read an article on this topic of Quicken last year, and did you know that that's over now and there's this new thing? And she just is fantastic with it. So, she was one of the first people that I wanted to hire. I had told her for a long time that, like, if I ever started another company, I would want to hire her first. And for Popular Power and for Wasabi, the efficiency of PR is amazing. We've never bought an online ad. We've never paid a dime other than to Debbie for any of the attention that we've gotten. And she does our screencasts, and she writes our press releases. She writes, she participates in the user forums. So if you find someone like that, lock them down, because they're very, very rare. But
needle in a haystack?
Yeah, yeah.
So how do you decide how much money to spend with her? Because we're actually paying a PR agent for our event, Future Online Advertising, for the first time. And it was weird because it's like, well, do we spend one day of her time or 20? And it can be a huge range. So how do you decide that?
She's compensated with equity at this point. She has twins, actually, and so she's at home and wanted to be able to work on this part-time. So
okay. Mike?
So we've had both experiences with a PR firm. So we started, November 2005 or something like that. It was like August 2005, we engaged a PR firm. And this was sort of before all this excitement was, Web 2.0, the first conference had happened. I think the second one happened that November. And so it wasn't really, it wasn't a term that was really even widely known online. And so we're like, hey, we've got this great online invoicing company. We've got customers. We've got a great story here. And we go to a PR firm. And they're like, yeah, let's get running. And so off we go. And sitting, a few months out, we're like, thanks a lot. We will stop using your services now. And we're going to go check out this phenomenon, but this emerging trend with this Web 2.0. And so fast forward to just a few months ago. We've been doing all our own PR since, and I would totally agree it's the right way to go. It's very cost effective. And what you can do is you can sort of test your story, figure out what works, what doesn't, who's interested. And it's sort of a momentum game. Because once you have a few stories, you can sort of play those off, or people have heard of you already, and it's just a lot easier. And so we have subsequently re-engage a PR firm. And for us now, it's like I never did it full time. I was amazingly efficient. I probably spent 20 minutes a week writing emails to people, just saying, hey, you know, whatever, and sort of networking through blogs and going to conferences and what have you. So we were really efficient for a while. And now we've been able to hand that off to a PR firm who is getting good results for us.
Okay.
So
cool.
Beatrice?
So I'll give you a couple of do's and don'ts for the PR and some other experiences. Well, first of all, we did get a great outcome out of press. So before we even launched an open to public, Time magazine has grabbed by chance hands on our application. We got chosen to 50 coolest websites, and we're on the front page of the CNN and Time magazine, and it really helps your traffic. It helps your customers. No doubt about it. And afterwards, it's also establishing a reputation for your company. After all, your customers have to trust you. This is the most important thing. And the press helps establish this trust because the journalists are testing the application. They recommend it to other users, and that's very important. So at the beginning, when we launched, we didn't have any formal policy, and then we were kind of hesitating what to do about it. We were looking at the freelancers, and I can tell you that back in 2003, we were looking for anything from $2,000 per month to $4,000 per month per person to actually go and pitch Mobissimo for us to the person that has a lot of contacts with the journalist. Then we were looking at PR agencies. And again, the cost may vary. If you are going to find a very small 2-3 people PR team, you may spend between $3,000 and $5,000 a month, and they can take equity. They can just defer payments. Those are wonderful people. They are very often entrepreneurs, just as you. So they may be just embarked on the company, and that happened to us. We were very lucky in this respect. And then you may have to hire just a PR agency. And the cost today, this year, actually, I've been talking to some of my friends. Well, they are rising because there are so many different startups launching. So when you could have a PR agency for $5,000 a month retainer, now you're looking for $7,000 to $10,000 a month. And at this price, it's becoming really expensive because there is another change in the market which you can take advantage of, and this is what we have started to take advantage of. It's blogs. It's just a fabulous tool for you to communicate both your personal blogs, company blogs, contacts with other people. Actually, in the audience, how many of you have your blogs? Okay, I think it's a great means of communication. If any of you would put a post in Mobissimo, more people will know about my company. I mean, I'm just joking, but you see, this is be creative. Marketing and the PR is also about being creative. We launched in India. We hired their PR agency. We did a press conference, and I would never be able to afford the press conference like this in the U.S. For 80 journalists together with the launch and all sorts of different things, it cost us $5,000, including gifts for the journalists. So just pick your market, and for each of your market and your audience, address it properly. The do's and don'ts. If a PR agency comes to you and tells you that they have to establish a messaging matrix, guys, you didn't do your homework. You don't know what your market is. You don't know what you want to convey to the user. Go back to the drawing table, but just don't take this company. And it's not so much their fault. It is because you don't know really what you want to do with your service. Otherwise, your peer people are just supposed to be your spokespeople. They are supposed to connect you to journalists. It's going to be your job to pitch the company, your job to explain what is it viable service. And at the end of the day, journalists will have their own opinion on that. So
definitely. Thanks. Next question.
I'm wondering what your guys' experience is in the relationship between capacity and growth. In the case of Mobissimo and Time magazine, I'm wondering if you guys wish you could go back in time and, you know, switch to the fancier server hardware before the article came out. I'm also wondering if you've observed the opposite relationship, where if you've added capacity, made your site faster and more responsive, you've seen user growth.
So do you mean should you spend money on more hardware initially to prepare for that?
Yeah.
So why don't you answer that, Beatrice?
Absolutely not. If I was to go back, I would do exactly as I did today, although probably I would make mistakes. But I think that I started Mobissimo in 2003 after many consumer companies, facing companies, have made a flop. So already to go to the VC to say that you are starting a travel search engine was like telling them that, you know, just going into total disaster. And then a lot of people made mistakes. They spend money for the so-called potential traffic that just never realized.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you have a traffic, if people are actually going to come and buy, and this is what happened to us, it was not only a traffic. We actually had customers that were buying travel online. And then afterwards, it's going to be either easy for you to take a loan or short-term loan to actually go towards the financing and ramp up your infrastructure. At the end of the day, if you are a very well-known service, and this is what happened to us, we called this $39 hosting company and said to them, guys, we are on the Time magazine, and you know, you don't look very well, so you have to help us. You have to borrow us some servers until we can actually ramp it up. Again, it's just a question of you being as creative as possible.
Also, you should seriously consider using S3 and EC2. I mean, if you don't know what that is, it's part of Amazon. Just go to aws.amazon.com. So, all right, next question.
I just want to say thanks to you guys first, but about being so open about your creations. It's really helpful and also pretty inspiring. I was wondering if you guys can talk a little bit about how long you've been up and the kind of user growth you've seen, and kind of specifically, what happened when you first came out there and you first launched, and how you sort of got that first critical mass or whatever of users that really sort of gave you the indication that what you're doing was working. And was
okay. Out. Mike, why don't you take that one?
Yeah. And can you just read
So the question basically is, what patterns have you seen in your growth? Did you see a big spike at the beginning and did it tail off? And what kind of, what's working for you really?
So thanks for the question. It's been sort of steady month over month double digit growth for us. So it's kind of turning into this exponential thing.
Double digit as in percentage or number of users?
basically every
why don't
metric.
You clarify that?
Every growth metric. Like, yeah. So, and that's been going on for sort of 3 years now, right? And there's a couple of things to consider there. One is, the nature of the business, right? Like, we're not a YouTube that's going to go viral one day and you're going to have, like, all of a sudden, like, millions of people watching a Saturday Night Live clip on the site, right? We're a business service and people gradually come and the word gets out and so it's steady. And that's a nice place to be in running a web app, believe it or not, because you're not having that fast thing, but you can grow steadily. And I think that this is something I would like to say on this with regards to growing a business and where we were at a while ago. Like, I wouldn't say we came out of the blocks and had, you know, phenomenal growth or anything to begin with. But we kind of knew that there was something there, and we decided, I think we were in that middle group. You know, you said, like, is it a total flop? Is there a little bit, or are you a success, right? And we were in that middle group, like, well, this could go somewhere, what have you. And we decided to commit to it, right? And I was working for a design development shop. We had a full-time staff, and we committed to running this business, and we did that a while ago. And I just wanted to say, I think that if you're in that middle group and you've had a little bit of success, like you're generating some revenue, chances are it's a business, and you should run it.
Totally. Yeah. All right, thanks. Let's take the next question.
Hi, guys. My question is, if for those of y'all who maybe started this, started your projects and you had another thing going on, at what point do you decide, hey, this is a real business that has some real potential, I really need to commit some more time to it and kind of, you know, drop off my other things that I have going on? And how do you decide at what point to do that?
Okay. Be interesting to hear your perspective, because you have got backing and I assume you're doing it full time. So that's kind of one model. I mean, it doesn't, you know, for DropSend and Wasabi, I think, and FreshBooks, we have kind of this user thing where we have number of users, sort of VC based, but for you it's more of an issue of, yeah, so when do you guys decide whether it's working or not, you know?
Sure.
For Maya's mom,
is your question, you have something on the side and you're wondering,
right,
whether, yeah, I mean, I don't know that I'm necessarily the right person to answer that, because what I did is I decided that I wanted to do this, told Yahoo, quit Yahoo, and launched it. So probably folks who had something, did something on the side, are better to answer.
Yeah, Mike, probably, or Mark, do you want to answer that first?
I mean, I think, you know, it's hard to give a very general answer to that. You know, if you have something on the side that's a very small business and you don't see a lot of potential for it, then that's one thing. If you see something and you think, well, I really think this could grow and be its own standalone business, you know, for me, I spent more than a year, I think it was about a year and a half, talking to people about their finances and their money and what stressed them out and what they might want help with and how that help might, you know, work, you know, how, what sort of product they would like. And there was a very long time where, you know, basically I felt kind of like, my co-founder and I both say, we felt kind of like priests. Like we would go around and say to people like, so how are you with money? And people would say, I've got to tell you, it's the biggest stress in my life, and start to talk to us about all of these things about money in their life. And getting from that validation point where we knew that there was a huge problem for people to, okay, now we have a product that we think might actually help with this, took a really long time. It took a lot of conversations. And, you know, my co-founder and I, although we've known each other since junior high, deciding to do a business together took a long time. It took us a couple months to decide that we wanted to work together on this project full time. And, you know, my advice would be give it time. You know, don't rush it. There's a lot of people will tell you, you have to run and get ahead of the competition and all this sort of stuff. And I don't believe that at all. I think that really the thing that you have to do is decide that it's something that you could see doing for 10 years. Decide that whoever you're starting it with, those people are people that, you know, you're willing to go through a really hard experience with. And if those things are true, then you should go out and do it. And if not, then don't.
Yeah. For us, we're in the perfect spot. That's a good question for us, because DropSend is very much still a side project, and it's profitable. And what we've decided to do is, I've got a business mentor now, and he said, listen, if you really want to sell this, you need to focus on it. You need to actually grow it and then sell it. So we've now decided to move one of our employees full-time onto it, which may sound dumb that we don't have any full-time, but it's not a full-time project at the moment. So there's two things. It's cash flow. You need to decide if it can support you doing it full-time, whether you're venture-backed or whether you're profit-backed. And then secondly, like Mark said, you need to hold off on the decision as long as possible. Mm-hmm. As long as possible.
I think it's such an. I'm going to add to it just because I think it's such an important question. There's a gut piece to this. Like you start thinking about it, and I work for small businesses building design development shops, and you meet all these entrepreneurs over the years, and a lot of them just get stuck, and they never like when you run a business. I know there's been like three phases in running FreshBooks where we've just taken a leap. You know, we've hired that next person, and it was, you know. You have to do it, or you never break out. So once you go from, even if you're committing half your time to a project, the difference between half and full is like a factor of 3 or 4. You're going to be so much more effective. And so if you're thinking about it, I just do it.
Cool. All right. That's the next question.
Hi. I was wondering, your dev costs were the most expensive thing in your initial startup.
Who are you speaking to?
It seemed across the board, one was zero, I think, because you did it yourself. what are your thoughts on outsourcing that overseas where dev costs are inexpensive, say using something like Elance?
Go ahead.
I think that it depends on how technical you are. If you can actively manage those people, I think it's an okay way to go. If you cannot, I would absolutely not recommend using someone overseas. It's cheap, but sometimes you get what you pay for, unless you really can be an active manager. I know a lot of people who have tried to do that and who very much regret what they've done, mostly because the architecture is not right or because, frankly, it does take a team. You absolutely need to have, I'm not sure who said it, but you absolutely need to have someone who understands the technology that can walk in to a venture firm or to angels and can be the face behind your product if you're the business person. If you're the technology person, I think it's a little easier, but I would be very cautious.
As a technology person, I would say I don't think it's easier. I feel like the case where you can say, I know exactly what I want and it's not going to change, that's where doing something on Elance is a totally great way to go. But if you're building a product, the likelihood is what you think you're going to do is not what you're going to do. And you know, if you have somebody who's very remote, who, you know, you're paying by the hour, who whatever, like that's a very inflexible situation. That's something where if you realize, wow, you know, we tried this feature and it didn't work, and you have to go through a 3-week process in order to change that feature, that's not going to work. So I would say that like the things that you keep close are the things that will be flexible. The things that are not going to change, I totally agree. Like one example, you know, if you have a little client program, you know exactly what it needs to do. It just needs to like check and see if there's new mail and then ping if there's mail. Great. Put that on Elance. Or you have a Flash, you know, movie that you want to do and you know exactly what it needs to do and it's not going to change that much. Great. You don't have to do everything yourself, but the things you keep close, you'll have flexibility with.
Beatrice, do you guys have in-house developers or have you outsourced?
We do both, and I have to tell you, okay, this is going to be always a compromise between the CTO and the founders in the company. You have to make choices for your company. You have to decide what is really a core technology for your company, and at Mobisimo, the Sakura was just a search engine, how we do add new suppliers, how we run multiple queries, and everything else is non-core. Means, for example, graphic designer is not core technology for us. We can outsource it, and we did outsource it. Once you got to a certain stage, let's say you're using API, there is no need to use a PhD in your company to build a widget on top of your API. So Mobisimo has an API. If I want to buy it, build a widget for NetVibes, for example, or Google page, I may actually outsource it to somebody else. So it all depends on what you want to do. There are certain things that you have to keep in house, just as Anne said, but there are certain things that you can definitely outsource to other people. Great. But before you launch to foreign countries, you have to have experience with dealing with people. So I have had in my two other previous companies an experience with dealing with foreign developers. They will have different style, they have a difference of time, and you have to be very good in writing specifications.
Yeah. Just a quick thought on that, and we'll move on. We just hired a Russian team for DropSend. And for us, actually, I kind of disagree in the sense. And the reason why is because if you do it in a way that they are a part of the company. So we've hired two people. They have an office just outside of Moscow. We speak to them every day. And they're a part of Carson Systems. So it's not outsourcing. And I think that's the key. Because these people, they have to be part of your company. And they have to believe that in the product. And they have to feel very much a part of it. And then you're right, it takes more management. But the idea there is you can cut some costs while also having dedicated people. And we just started it last month, and so far it's working for us. So, but let's go to the next question.
Great. First of all, I really want to applaud everyone for coming and talking about this. We really appreciate it. My question is around insurance, business insurance, and I'm kind of in a situation as Mike right now with Development Shop, and we have side businesses that we've started, and I'm really finding it difficult, and I'm dealing with the Canadian market as well, so just so you're aware there, but in terms of business insurance, how's the process been for you, and are people gun shy at working with you, especially in the banking situation? You know, you're dealing with sensitive data.
And do you mean actually buying insurance?
Yeah, having like business insurance.
Okay, Mike, do you want to answer that?
I just put it in the cat. Well, like for them to deal with us, or is it a good decision for you?
Well, no, for them to deal with you. So finding vendors that will want to work with an e-tailer or online components and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's always handy to have relationships. You know, I mean, we were in this. You got to shop around a little. We looked into this in depth a while back, and it really also depends a lot on the kind of information you're storing. You got to explore for yourself. There's so many variables. I wish I had a good answer for you on that one, but it's it really depends.
Okay. Thank you. Let's move on.
Thanks, guys. Again, I had a question. I wanted to see if anybody wants to think back to one of your darker days or more frustrating days and share any mistakes or pitfalls or money poorly spent, anything that we then can avoid and learn from you.
Great. So let's talk about our worst mistakes. You want to start off, Ann?
Sure. I'm trying to think of the worst mistake. I think probably, as I mentioned, the most important thing is to get something out as quickly as possible and as simply as possible. I think a lesson that I've learned is things don't have to have a lot of bells and whistles to be very helpful. What we thought would be compelling, most compelling about our offering, turned out to be fine. But what really was most compelling was the very basics of moms and some dads, but talking to each other. Human connection, communication, stuff that I knew it would be helpful, but I didn't think it'd be the draw. And we could have put something out that was as basic a tool as allowing people to talk to each other and journal about their kids' lives and save photos and share photos probably 3 months before we did. So I guess I would say keeping simplicity in mind is probably the biggest pitfall that one could run into.
So you wish you would have kept it more simple.
Yeah.
And then changed from
there. Yeah, and then add features as you see what's being used.
Okay. Mark?
I think I already mentioned what I think of as the biggest mistakes, which were trying to not spend money on people whose full attention you need. Both in the case of an early developer that we worked with and with the law firm, we made a decision to try and compensate them in equity or have deferred compensation. And that's fine if you're not going to come to a halt if that person gets busy with the thing that's actually paying them money. But, if you depend on that person delivering every day and they have something else that they have to do in order to get paid money, that's a very tough position to put yourself and them in. So I guess what I would just say is, spend money on the stuff that is going to keep you moving forward. And it's great to be cheap. We haven't spent one dime on office space. We salvage desks from anywhere we can. Like, all of that sort of stuff is great. But, if we don't have a desk, we all have laptops, and that's going to be fine. If we don't have a developer, that's not fine. So if you think to yourself, I absolutely positively need this person to deliver, pay them.
Mike?
Yeah, I think for one, it really helps to, for me at least, I can only really speak personally about this stuff, and it so much of a bad day is about perspective, right? And I love solving problems. That's just part of my makeup. So when things are bad, like normally I just, it psychs me up, and I'm like, okay, how can we deal with this? So I guess I'm lucky in the sense that that's sort of my attitude for this stuff. We've made some mistakes along the way. First time around with PR, we had to rename our company because we didn't invest in that, and that was kind of a drag. But I just chalk those up as business learning. So dark days for me, and there's been like five or six, I'd say, are just days when communication's a little bit strained with the people that I just love working with. Like, we have a great team, and there's been a couple times, especially in the early days, when I was so psyched about stuff. Joe, who I work with, who founded the company with me, he always works remotely, if we haven't had time to check in on something, and that gnaws at me overnight, then just getting up the next day and addressing it right away, those are the ones for me.
Okay, Beatrice.
Mistakes. No, I never make mistakes. I think the most important part for me was to just realize that actually growing a company, beyond anything else, it's about working with people. And any startup, it's about the team, it's about the partners that you're going to choose to work with. And you may make a mistake in that respect. So you may realize after 2 years or 3 years that actually one of the founders, and it was our case, may not necessarily follow exactly the same vision, the same path. It may be one of your employees as well. So, everybody has this wisdom say that hire slowly and fire fast. I think that this is probably one of the most difficult decisions in the startup to take when you have to separate somebody from the company and you have to take this decision to cut off.
Okay. So. Just quickly, the biggest mistake we've made is not investing in customer service. And what I mean by that is the back end to DropSend makes it hard for me to do customer service. So someone will email me and say, I got charged, $5 and, all my sends are gone and I didn't use them. you know, and I don't have time to look in that. And what I need to be able to do is just give them more sense. But because of the way the database works, I can't easily do that. And that is a nightmare. And so what I would say is when you're building your app, think about the customer service you're going to do and enable the back end of the app to do that easily and quickly, because you don't want to piss your customers off. And so the more that you can, the quicker you can respond to them when they're upset, and you can give them things or fix things or cancel their accounts if they ask for that or upgrade their accounts, do that. You know, just have search functionality built into your back end so you can easily find accounts, and that's one mistake we made. So we've got time for one more.
Great. I was wondering, how many of you have business mentors, and what advice do you have on finding people like that?
Okay. Yeah.
I have an advisory board that consists of lots of great people. And the way I find them is the way I found all of my people. They're almost all former Yahoo people. And I think that's really the best way to find them, people who you've worked with before or people... I think that's the way to find them. If you don't have that, I would start posting on blogs and come to conferences like this and try to find them. But I think having a mentor who will call your bullshit and will challenge you is incredibly important.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I mean, I've been lucky for this company in that I'm working with an advisory board of people that I all already knew, and the board member that we just added was somebody that I already knew as well. So, you know, having done it before, you're going to have more resources. If you haven't done it before, a lot of the people that I met the first time around, as Anne says, were former coworkers. Others were people that I met at conferences. I think it's totally fine and legitimate to walk up to people and ask them if they, you know, do any advising for entrepreneurs. And, you know, I do that all the time. And for me, it's great because, you know, I sit down and talk to people about what they're working on. And I think entrepreneurs are generally really fun to talk to when they're working on something they're fired up about. And so, yeah, I mean, I would suspect any of us on the panel would probably be willing to do that. And I think any of the panels just walk up to people and say, hey, I'm working on this. Can you help?
Before we move on quickly, do you guys compensate your advisors at all officially?
Yeah, people who have agreed to be on our advisory board get equity. I have other informal advisors who don't.
Cool.
Same.
Cool.
Yeah, we don't. And what we ended up doing is giving options to them because if
but you do have you do have advisors or mentors.
Pardon?
You do have mentors.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, we have, and it's probably one of the best things you can do for yourself. Absolutely, advisors for sure. Ideally, you want people who want to get involved with you and don't want equity. So along those lines, a good thing to do is just, seriously, yeah, and I'd make true. It a constraint. Like, don't take somebody who, that's my opinion on it, and go find somebody who's retired or semi-retired. We've got a Harvard MPA, former Fortune 100, we've two guys who are former, and they're advisors, and they're, you know, Fortune 100 management people. And they just wanted to get involved, and one of them semi-retired, and he loves it. He absolutely loves it because he spent 40 years of his life running business, and now just to be involved, you'd be surprised who will line up for free.
Well, Bissimo has advisor board. We have a board of the company, but I have to tell that at each stage of the company, it's a totally different story. When I started Mobissimo, my biggest help was from other entrepreneurs, with whom I would sit down and talk about what challenges they are facing. We were comparing the notes on valuations, on traffic acquisitions, and so on. And you probably will find two or three entrepreneurs like that that will be just your sort of peers and somebody to look up to for an example. In the advisory board, I have one person with whom I work very, very closely, and that means we are meeting twice a month for at least an hour. And we are not talking necessarily about the metrics and strategy, but also how to improve to be an entrepreneur and CEO,
yeah,
and how to run it better. Then in Silicon Valley, and this is something that we have recently started, we are working also on the, you know, there are CEO groups, there are founders groups. We were looking at creating a women's founder group because we are facing a little bit different issues that you gentlemen here.
Yeah.
It's not easy to run the company when you're a female. It's not easy to raise money because even here in the audience, I can see it's probably than 5% of females. So that's probably the same ratio when you go fundraising. Your visas may not be used to the style of pitch and so on. So it's good to kind of have a sanity check with your peers about whatever it's kind of a normal situation or not. And you will find at every stage of the company that there will be different people that will be needed to you, sometimes as friends simply.
Yeah, so we've got to pretty much finish there. I've got a mentor and I love him, and I just walked up to him at a coffee shop, and he's a millionaire and he's a smart guy and it works for us. So I'd highly, highly recommend it. Somebody you trust. And that's it. Please give them a big hand.
Thanks for having us.